One of the issues I work on is political violence. I try to understand the issues that drive political violence, and I try to locate these issues in a historical context, specifically in the context of colonialism, post-colonialism. Most of my work, not all of it, is in the African context. So before I began research for this book on Darfur and Sudan, I had worked on Rwanda, Congo, Angola, and I was used to African crises developing, as it were, in the middle of the night, seldom seen or reported in the international press. And so I was struck by how different was the reportage on Darfur. Darfur was different. It was globalized almost from the outset. And I wondered why. And I realized that actually the answer was very simple, which was that Darfur was the focus of a domestic political movement in the U.S., the Save Darfur Coalition. In 2008, when I was in Darfur, in El Fasher, talking to a UN humanitarian officer, I said to him, I said, Save Darfur raised $14 million last year. How much of it did it send to Darfur? And his response was nothing. So when I went back to New York City, which is where I live 9 months of the year, have lived for the last 10 years, teaching at Columbia, I called up somebody I knew in the Save Darfur offices in Washington, D.C., and I said, hey, I was told that you didn't send any of your collections to Darfur. And he said, well, we're not an aid agency, we are an advocacy group. And I said, fair enough. So I began to follow this advocacy. And of course, I realized that the Save Darfur group had to be credited with one thing, which was that it brought this particular conflict, the suffering around it, the mass slaughter of 2003-2004, that it gave it publicity. But I also realized, as the years went on, that Save Darfur publicity and the Darfur that this publicity framed was very different from the Darfur that I was coming to know through my own research. And I began to notice some major distortions. So I want to begin by just discussing some of the distortions. The first big distortion had to do with the question of how many people died in Darfur at the height of the violence, 2003-2004. In 2006, an agency of the U.S. government called Government Accountability Office, GAO, which is an audit agency. Its job is to audit other agencies and to ensure reasonable honesty. So the GAO got together with the U.S. Academy of Sciences and appointed a panel of 12 experts and asked them to evaluate 6 estimates of mortality in Darfur in 2003-2004. The high-end estimate was from the Save Darfur associated researchers, 400,000 dead. And the low-end estimate was from WHO, World Health Organization, 50,000 to 70,000 dead. All 12 experts unanimously agreed that the high-end estimates were the least reliable because they extrapolated from a small sample to the entire province across space and across time. And they agreed that the most reliable estimate was coming from a WHO-associated research unit in Belgium known as CRED, which had an estimate of roughly 112,000 dead. Big difference, 112,000, 400,000. The next issue was about whether those dead had been killed. In other words, Was there more than one cause of death? The WHO report claimed that 70 to 80% of those who had died from the consequence of drought and desertification. They had died of diarrhea and dysentery, and most of the dead were children and infants. And that 20 to 30% had died from the effects of direct violence, or from direct violence. Now, those who work on extreme violence would know that there's a gray zone here. In other words, how many of the children who died of diarrhea and dysentery would have survived if there was no conflict and if they could have gotten access to treatment? So there is a gray zone. There's grounds for more research, further refinement. But all I'm saying is that there was more than one cause of death, and the drought and desertification preceded the conflict, was not triggered by the conflict. There was a third issue, which had to do more with silence than a direct distortion. And the silence was about the violence. So you have first the claim of 400,000, then you have roughly 112,000 dead, then the CRED estimate of those who died from direct violence being plus minus 35,000. So if you focus on those 35,000, the question was, did this violence have a history? Was this violence driven by issues? I'm asking this because if you went to a Save Darfur website, you would see a catalog of atrocities, death or murder, rape, burnings of villages, a documentation of atrocities. Then you would get an identification of perpetrators and victims. The idea is naming and shaming, what I call demonizing the perpetrator, and the demand is punishment, criminal justice. I think Save Darfur shares this framing with most human rights agencies. If you read a report from Human Rights Watch or from International Crisis Group, the first page or two will be a pro forma account of history context, but then they move on to the main atrocities, naming and shaming, demand for punishment. I thought that this framing was actually shared with the war on terror, because the assumption was that violence is its own explanation. That violence is driven by perpetrators, it's not driven by issues. That any attempt to discuss issues is an attempted apology for the violence, is an attempt to distract attention from the perpetrator. It is an attempt, presumably, to apologize for the perpetrator. I thought this seamless sharing of this kind of framing, to me, it seemed to make the publicity of the Save Darfur campaign as part of the publicity of the war on terror. But I'll have more to say about it. So I got interested in the history of the violence and the question of whether the violence was driven by issues. And in my research, I concluded that the first phase of the violence had been in 1987-89. That prior to 1987, most conflicts in Darfur were local conflicts, isolated, between neighbors, relatively easily settled through reconciliation conferences. But something changed in 1987. In 1987 began a conflict which almost from the start was a province-wide conflict. It was no longer about boundaries. And in fact, it was waged with an unparalleled brutality. The kind of brutality that nobody could recall from their historical memory. Well, what had changed? Why? Why this sudden shift? Like in any major conflict, there was not one explanation. There were several causes. The deep cause had to do with the land question. Contemporary land tenure in Darfur originates from the colonial period, the British colonial period, when all land in Darfur was divided up as tribal homeland. But in the division of tribal homeland, more land was given to settled tribes than nomadic tribes. And the fully nomadic tribes, the camel nomads of the north, who have no settled villages, who move year-round, received no tribal homeland. That was the deep cause. The trigger was the drought. According to the UN Environmental Program, the report published a year before last, a four-decade-long drought which began in the mid-40s. By the mid-80s, the southern boundary of the Sahara had extended by 100 kilometers, pushing the camel nomads down south. And as they headed down south, they went for the best land in central Darfur. That is a 70 to 80 kilometer long mountain range, the Jabal Mara. And there ensued a classic ecological conflict between peasants and nomads over who would control this land. It was clear whoever would control it would survive the drought. Whoever wouldn't stood to perish. I thought this was the main explanation for the unparalleled brutality with which this conflict was waged. But there was a third factor which had nothing to do with Darfur, but which explained the heightened level of technology with which the civil war was fought. Because in 1980, Darfur and the region, which is Darfur and neighboring Chad, got integrated into a wider global conflict, the conflict we know as the Cold War. Reagan came to power in the US in 1980. The day after he took office, he pronounced Libya a terrorist state. And this part of Africa became one of the foci of the Cold War. Chad, which had been the focus of a civil war since independence, now that civil war got integrated into a wider conflict. One side in the civil war was supported by an alliance of the US, France, and Israel. The second side was supported by Libya and the Soviet Union. If the government was in power in N'Djamena, the opposition crossed the border into Darfur. It is in Darfur that the opposition trained, armed, mobilized, and from where it attacked. Darfur became militarized in the process. By the mid-80s, when there was not a drop of water in Darfur, the place was awash with AK-47s and bazookas and whatever. Darfur became to Chad what later Eastern Congo would become to Rwanda. The opposition in Rwanda would cross the border into Eastern Congo. It would mobilize, arm, train, and attack from Eastern Congo. In the process, Eastern Congo got militarized. And so did Darfur. I thought there was a further distortion. The violence in Darfur declined dramatically from around September 2004. The reason for this decline had to do, in my view, mainly with the work of the African Union. Because the African Union was the only external force that came into Darfur with the understanding that there could be no military solution to the problem, that the only solution had to be political. It succeeded in bringing the parties to the civil war together in N'Djamena, concluding an agreement. The level of decline of violence was dramatic. According to UN on-the-ground officers, the average numbers of those killed from violence after January 2005 were less than 200 a month. The only newspaper to report this was The Independent in London. The reports of Julie Flint, who went in and out of Darfur and bothered to interview individual UN officers. Because the UN head office in New York kept on giving a different story. The story that is repeated in the media over and again. The story that was given by John Holmes, the Undersecretary for Humanitarian Affairs, in 2008, when he gave a speech saying 300,000 had died. 200,000 died in 2003-2004 of combined effects, without bothering to spell out what these combined effects were. And he added, if the same trends continued, 300,000 must have died by now. Well, where did he get the figure of 200,000? And why the assumption, if the same trends continue? This morning I had a television interview on BBC World, and the interviewer began by saying, looking at the audience and saying, 300,000 have died in Darfur. This was a statement. It was not meant to be a provocation. It's meant to provide the background. And he looked at me, I said, you're talking of the marketing of grief. These are marketing figures. So let's begin with the figures. Well, if you peel it like an onion and take off the layers of distortions, a kernel remains, and I want to acknowledge that. There was a slaughter in Darfur in 2003-2004. CRED estimates plus minus 35,000. It's a huge figure, not a small figure. The only word I can use for it is a massacre. There's no doubt in my mind that the responsibility for that slaughter must belong to the political authority of the government of Sudan. Can't belong anywhere else. But the real question is, the important question is, what to do about it? I will come to that question at the end. But first, I want to talk a little more about this movement, Save Darfur, because I think it represents a new kind of mobilization that we need to be aware of. We need to grasp what is new about it. Because much is familiar. When I first began to read about it and research it, I thought of it immediately as in a line of mobilizations in the US. The 1960s anti-war movement, the 1980s anti-apartheid movement. But then I realized that, of course, Save Darfur was not a peace movement. It was a war mobilization. Listen to the slogans. Boots on the ground, out of Iraq, into Darfur. Listen to the demands. Sanctions, no-fly zone, more soldiers, shift of demand from African Union to the UN. I didn't speak about it, but maybe if somebody is interested later, I will speak about that shift of command and the many ways in which the African Union was deliberately discredited and sabotaged. The soldiers on the ground remain African, but the command shifted to New York. So this was really a war mobilization. But it was different in other ways too. If you look at the anti-war movement of the 1960s and the anti-apartheid movement of the 1980s, the signature activity of these movements was the teaching. These movements hoped to bring students face to face with educators. And the point of the teaching was to create context, history, politics. There was colonialism. There was the anti-colonial struggle. There were the French. Now there are the Americans. What are the connections? Connect the dots, as Rumsfeld would say. Right? Save Darfur has nothing but contempt for education and for educators. It does not seek to bring educators, historians, scholars of Darfur into the movement. It seeks to bring media celebrities, from George Clooney to Mia Farrow. The more its mobilization has succeeded, the more it has gone down from colleges to high schools. I call the high school children the high school brigade of Save Darfur, America's version of Africa's child soldiers. Because look, the attempt is to completely depoliticize the conflict, completely present it as purely moral, purely moral. I know at Columbia, when I teach my students, a number of my students belong to Save Darfur mobilization. Our son goes to high school in New York City. A number of his friends belong to this mobilization. And I would ask myself, I would say, how come these students who are American, this is the period between 2003 and 2008. Remember, 2003, there was a global mobilization against the Iraq war. And then it just sort of fizzled out, like mist on the ground. Came back in 2008 with the presidential campaign. But between then, the only show was Save Darfur. And I would say, how come these students are not mobilizing around Iraq? Why are they mobilizing around Darfur? When Tariq Ali came to New York and we talked on a forum, and he said to me, you know why? The answer is simple. The answer is, he said, that there's no draft around Iraq. There was a draft around Vietnam. I said, but there's no draft around Darfur. Let's focus on what is happening. Let's not focus on what is not happening. Why are they mobilizing around Darfur? I recall that when I first came to the U.S. as a student, before Henry and I met, I remember being so surprised, being in a country where people were so generous when it came to giving to charities, to philanthropy. And I remember being so puzzled that the same people who would give so generously to charities were so stingy when it came to paying taxes. They hated to pay taxes. The same people who could give millions to charities would spend millions hiring smart lawyers so they didn't have to pay taxes. I couldn't figure out why. Now, when I saw this Darfur mobilization, I began to get a clue as to why. You know, when my students would discuss Iraq, they would inevitably give it context. They would discuss Iraq as Americans, as citizens. What would happen if we withdraw from Iraq? Wouldn't the Sunnis kill the Shias, kill the Kurds? Now, however elementary, whether you agree with it or not, it's an attempt to discuss it politically. But when they discussed Darfur, they never discussed it politically. Darfur was a site of evil. That's all it was. Good against evil. Darfur was a place to feel good. It was a site of feel-good politics. My students understood that in Iraq, when they talked Iraq, when they faced Iraq, they either felt guilty or they felt humbled because Iraq demonstrated the limits of American power. When they discussed Darfur, they didn't discuss it as Americans, as citizens. They discussed Darfur as humans. And in Darfur, they could feel what they were not in Iraq, which is powerful saviors. Darfur was a refuge from Iraq. It was a shelter. It was running away from Iraq. Well, let me come to the big question. What needs to be done? I said, and I repeat it because I want to be absolutely clear here, that I have no doubt where the political responsibility for the slaughter of 2003-2004 belongs. Set apart the marketing of Save Darfur. So what does one do about it? There are two paradigms that can illuminate for us a possible course of action. The paradigm that guides most of the human rights movement, especially the international NGOs, is what I would call the Nuremberg paradigm. The Nuremberg paradigm is undergirded by two assumptions. The first assumption is that the conflict has ended. Winners and their losers. So now you can have courts under the power of the winners, and you can take to court those who committed atrocities, and you can punish them. That's the first assumption. The second assumption, which is far more serious but is implicit, is that yesterday's perpetrators and victims will not have to live together tomorrow. They will be in Israel. There'll be two separate political communities. For the victims, there'll be Israel. Now, neither of these assumptions hold in the case of African conflicts. First of all, most of the conflicts are ongoing conflicts. So the real challenge is how to stop the conflict. We're not discussing Darfur after victory or defeat. So challenge one, how do you stop the conflict? But more important, there's no Israel. The whites and blacks in South Africa would have to live together after apartheid. The Hutu and Tutsi in Rwanda or Burundi would have to live together after the genocide. There's no Israel for anybody. Which means that whatever solution you arrive at cannot simply be fashioned to settle accounts with the past. It has to be fashioned with an eye on the future too. You must ensure a future for the living. I would say that is the greatest priority, that the living must have a second chance. How do you live together? I think it is this predicament which has brought to us an alternative paradigm, which I identify with Kempton Park, where the talks to settle, to resolve the question of apartheid were held. Basically, Kempton Park was based on the assumption that we must think of justice not simply as criminal justice, but also as political justice. And that, in fact, in an ongoing conflict, political justice is far more important than criminal justice. Not only more important, it's an alternative. You can't have both. Either you try to put the leadership of apartheid on trial, or you won them over to a political reform by guaranteeing them amnesty. Let's use the word impunity. Forgive the past, but don't forget it. The rules must change here and now. That was the Kempton Park resolution. Remember Steve Biko's murderers were taken to court? They were released by the court. Why? Not because the case couldn't be proven, but because there was a higher interest at stake, said the court. That's the political interest of resolving the conflict. I suggest to you that every conflict in Africa that has been settled since then has followed this model. Mozambique followed this model. Remember RENAMO? It was a movement which kidnapped children, forced the children to carry out acts of terror against adults, usually in their own family. You had child perpetrator victims. Same in northern Uganda. Same in Sierra Leone, RUF. If there had been an ICC, the leadership of RENAMO would have been in court and in jail, but the conflict would have been going on. But the leadership of RENAMO sits in parliament like the leadership of the National Party in South Africa. The same solution was applied in South Sudan. The violence in South Sudan was much worse than in Darfur. There were no criminal trials in South Sudan. Political reform over criminal trials and criminal justice. That was the agreement. So why not Darfur? Thank you.